This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Jack Greenberg, is one of two surviving lawyers who argued the cases that were combined in Brown versus Board of Education. May 17th marks the 50th anniversary of the Supreme Court decision, which declared state-sanctioned segregation of the schools to be unconstitutional. The lead lawyer on the case was Thurgood Marshall, who then headed the NAACP's Legal Defense and Educational Fund. In 1961, when Marshall left the group and became the first African-American Supreme Court Justice, Greenberg replaced him as head of the LDF. He worked with the group for 35 years, then left to join the faculty of Columbia Law School. He became dean of Columbia College. Greenberg's memoir, Crusaders in the Courts, Legal Battles of the Civil Rights Movement, has just been published in a new edition. Would you describe what your role was in Brown versus Board of Education?
Okay. My role in Brown v. Board of Education started when a lawyer in Topeka sent in a draft complaint to the offices of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund for approval and asked for us to edit it if anything had to be done. And I did some considerable editing to it and sent it back to him. Actually, at that point, it wasn't called Brown. There was a bunch of names in random order, and he alphabetized them. So B with Brown got up there at the top. Though I think it's amusing now, and perhaps an irony, that there were two families named Brown in the case, Oliver Brown and Darlene Brown, neither related to the other. And he named it Oliver Brown, which, of course, was not strict alphabetical order, because Oliver was a man.
That's a great paradox, yes.
That's right. And I think as a result, partially as a result of Brown against Board of Education, that would not happen again today. So I was trial lawyer in that case along with Robert Carter. Then there was another case in Delaware, two other cases in Delaware called Gebhardt against Belton. I was the trial lawyer in that with a lawyer called Louis Redding. Then the two of us argued that in the Supreme Court of the United States. And we won those cases in the courts below.
Now, the Delaware case was the first decision that ordered black children to be admitted to white schools.
That's right.
What was the argument that you made in the lower court in 1952?
Well, it was the same argument we made in the other cases. We argued that the schools were unequal in a physical sense, and the classrooms weren't as good. Actually, they had six grades in two rooms in one of the Delaware cases. In another one of the cases, there wasn't even a black high school in the town. The student had to travel to another town to go to high school. But we also argued that segregation itself was unconstitutional, that just the mere fact of setting people aside because of their race was unconstitutional. And one of the reasons it was unconstitutional was that it impaired, interfered with a black child's ability to learn it. Labeled him as a second-class citizen, and that didn't make him feel very good.
Yes, you also brought up the psychological effects of segregation.
That's right. Well, that's what I was referring to. We had psychologists and a psychoanalyst who'd examine the kids, testify in the case, and he said that he came to the perfectly obvious conclusion that it was harmful to their mental well-being to separate them on the basis of race.
Help explain this to me. Although you won the case, the judge didn't say that, well, segregation is illegal because, Plessy versus Ferguson upheld legal separation. So can you explain what the judge ruled and how he was affected by Plessy?
The case was based, our argument is two different sorts. One is that the black schools were physically, measurably, visibly unequal to the white schools, and consequently there was an inequality and the black children should not be excluded from the white school. Then there was the argument that segregation itself was unconstitutional, no matter even if the schools were identical, it would be unconstitutional. And the judge, who was really a very courageous, excellent, wonderful man, said, look, I think segregation is unconstitutional, but I'm just a lower court judge. And I don't have the authority to overrule the Supreme Court of the United States. And so I'm going to order these children admitted on the grounds that the schools are physically unequal. We know that they're not permitted to do that. And as to the rest, I leave that to the Supreme Court of the United States.
How was it decided to take the Topeka case, which you'd worked on, the Delaware case, which you'd worked on, and three other cases pertaining to school desegregation, and combine them into one test case before the Supreme Court?
Well, I think that was, in large part, the Supreme Court's own decision, because, for example, the District of Columbia case had not even been decided in the Court of Appeals. It was just there awaiting argument in the Court of Appeals. And the clerk of the United States Supreme Court called the lawyer in the case, James Neybert, and said, if you will file a petition for us asking the Supreme Court to review the case even before it's been decided in the Court of Appeals, we'll grant that petition. And he did that, and the Supreme Court essentially plucked that case up out of pre-decision and took it. In our case, the Delaware case, we couldn't appeal because we had won. We were in a funny kind of position. We wanted to have it heard in the Supreme Court, but you can't appeal a case that you've won. So we had a hope that the Attorney General of Delaware would appeal the case, and happily he did. But he did at a point when the case would not have been heard that same year with the other cases. He did it so late it would have been heard with the others. And we filed a motion, what's called a motion to advance, to move our case up very quickly, and the Supreme Court granted that. So it wanted to hear all those cases together.
What were the controversies within the NAACP and the larger civil rights community about whether this was the best way to attack the cause of civil rights and whether the schools were the best place to challenge Plessy versus Ferguson?
Well, at the time of the Brown case, there was some controversy, but it was insignificant. There was a newspaper journalist / lawyer, his name was Marjorie McKenzie, and she wrote some columns saying we should have done it some other kind of way. Harry Ashmore was the editor of the Little Rock Gazette, who was one of the few whites who was pro-civil rights, thought we shouldn't bring the case because we would lose it. But otherwise, it was pretty much unanimous. The real controversy had existed as far back as the late 30s, when W.E.B. Du Bois and those who disagreed with him, namely the NAACP and what a man called Charles Thompson, who was dean of the Howard University Graduate School of Education, disagreed on whether or not they should go for integration or equalization, and Du Bois was in favor of equalization. But the integration forces won on the ground that equalization, A, would never be achieved, which I think is quite clear, and that, B, there's no such thing as being separate and equal because you're marginalized, you're stigmatized, you're out of the mainstream, and you can't possibly be equal.
Was the goal of Brown, in your eyes, to overturn Plessy versus Ferguson?
The goal of Brown was far more than school integration. It was essentially to break up the entire racist system which rested on segregation. It was not just school integration. It was, I mean, you could not, for example, have integrated schools in a segregated society. It was self-contradictory. And the goal was to put an end to racial segregation. And the Supreme Court agreed with that because 1 week after the decision in Brown, they handed down three or four decisions in which the opinion merely said Brown against Board of Education. And those decisions involved a beach and a golf course and a municipal theater. The psychological effects of segregation had nothing to do with your ability to enjoy those places, except that segregation itself was an impediment to living a full life.
My guest is Jack Greenberg, one of the lawyers who argued the cases that were combined in Brown versus Board of Education. When you were making your argument, what was the toughest question you were asked by one of the judges, or by one of the justices?
Well, the question really wasn't tough, and I gave the right answer, but he wasn't satisfied at the time, Justice Frankfurter. You see, we had won our cases in the court below, and we couldn't appeal, because you can't appeal something that you've won. So we had hope the other side would appeal. The other side did appeal, and We had not won our case on the basis of the unconstitutionality of segregation. We'd won our case on the basis that the schools were unequal. Before the Supreme Court, I argued that segregation was unconstitutional. And Justice Frankfurter said, well, why didn't you cross-appeal? Why didn't we appeal the fact that the court had not ruled with us on the grounds of unconstitutionality of segregation rather than just on the grounds of inequality? Well, the reason we hadn't is if we had done that, the other side would have 30 days to answer, and then we would not be in, we would not have our case heard that term. I try to explain that, and I said, look, you can affirm the decision that we've won below, but affirm it on the ground that segregation is unconstitutional, not on the, and don't have to treat that as a new and separate ground. And we went round and round with that. But in the end, that's what they did.
Where were you when you actually heard the decision?
I was in the office of the Legal Defense Fund at 107 West 43rd Street in New York, and Thurgood Marshall was in Washington, and he was in court when the decision came down, and he called me.
What did he say?
He said, we won. It was unanimous. And he was going to get the next plane and come up to New York.
When you got a chance to actually read the decision, what did you think of it and of the decision as written by Earl Warren? What did you think of the writing?
I thought it was wonderful, and I still do. And if I had a nitpick, I'd pick a couple of little things that are not very important. But there's an entire industry that is developed of lawyers and law professors who write about what was wrong with Brown against Board of Education. There's something about the academic calling which says that you have to find out what's wrong with something. And there are whole books written about it and articles and essays and collections and so forth. And there's even a book out which essentially is how I would have written Brown against Board of Education better. And most of the people who contributed to that have written it only longer.
Brown was handed down in 1954. A year later, the Supreme Court justices issued a related decision, Brown 2, in which they said that desegregation of the schools should be carried out with all deliberate speed. What did you think of that second decision, and how did you interpret with all deliberate speed?
Well, I have to answer that in retrospect. The all deliberate speed decision didn't merely say all deliberate speed. It said some things that nobody would argue with. It said you have to make a prompt and reasonable start. You can take only time to make administrative changes, like, you know, draw up some new zone lines and reassign teachers and so forth. You may not delay desegregation because of opposition to it. Everybody would agree with that. And then you should proceed with all deliberate speed. That was put in there as a way of getting, probably as a way of getting a couple of justices who might have dissented from not dissenting, probably Reed and Jackson. It was thought it was worth doing that in order to get a unanimous decision. And given the absolutely incredible opposition and massive resistance that had occurred, there are those who think that if there were a couple of dissenting opinions, it would have been worse. We don't know, but there's a pretty good reason to believe that. So that's the justification for all deliberate speed. Did all deliberate speed slow things down? Well, after Brown came down, 101 congressmen signed something called a Congressional Manifesto. Congressmen and senators did that, which they denounced the Supreme Court. All the southern states adopted something called resolutions of interposition and nullification. It's pretty hard to know what that means, but they means they sure didn't like it. And that's what they adopted on the eve of the Civil War. And I won't go into all the details, but they appropriated money to fight the Brown decision, and passed constitutional amendments to close public schools. The blacks went there, and they raised all kinds of procedural and bureaucratic impediments to black kids going to white schools. They tried to disbar civil rights lawyers. They enjoined civil rights organizations from functioning and so forth. I find it hard to believe that if the Supreme Court had said desegregate immediately, they would not have done that. They would have done exactly the same thing, maybe worse. And that being the case, that's what slowed down the integration of the schools. The schools could not integrate themselves. They could not integrate in the face of opposition. There were five lawyers at the Legal Defense Fund. They could not have done it. You couldn't have done it without the Civil Rights Acts being passed. They weren't passed till 64. So I think all deliberate speed did not slow things down. Now, I have to say there's some disagreement with that. Some people think that if the court hadn't said all deliberate speed, a lot of places would have desegregated and it would have created a momentum. I just don't think so.
Did you celebrate on the night of the unanimous decision?
As a matter of fact, we did not. That's about the only time we did not celebrate. We just were sort of, you know, in a bit of a fog. We were sort of stunned.
Stunned by what?
Well, just the immensity of the what it all meant. It was, it was pretty staggering. It put an end to essentially something that the Civil War was unable to end.
Were the plaintiffs in Brown versus Board of Ed harassed during or after the case? And how were you affected by that?
Some of the plaintiffs were very, very badly harassed. In South Carolina, the home was burnt down. The credit was cut off. Family, the Delane family were the plaintiffs there. They were very badly harassed. Their lives were in danger. The plaintiffs in the Virginia case, I don't know, but I think they probably were also. In Delaware, there was nothing adverse that was done to them that I've ever heard of. Same in the District of Columbia. And in Topeka, I don't believe anything was done. As to me, in those cases, no, I was not affected at all. In some other cases, I was in danger, though usually in almost all cases, I was not aware of that till after I got my FBI files, many, many years later.
What did you learn from the FBI files?
Oh, there were various white supremacist groups talking about killing, quote, Jew Jack Greenberg. But they never got around to it, I guess.
My guest is Jack Greenberg, one of the lawyers who argued the cases that were combined in Brown versus Board of Education. His memoir, Crusaders in the Courts, has just been published in a new edition. Now, in your memoir, which has just been republished, called Crusaders in the Courts, you write, "What had all our efforts achieved by June 1960 in five states of the Deep South, Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, and South Carolina? Not a single black child attended an integrated school. In Arkansas, Florida, North Carolina, Tennessee, and Virginia, the numbers of black children attending white schools ranged from 34 to 169. When did it start to hit you that this monumental decision was not having the kind of actual impact that you wanted it to?
Well, I'm going to have to qualify your question a little bit, because Brown was more than a case about integrating schools, though it certainly was in terms of that, and it did involve that. Brown was a case about tearing the whole regime of segregation, and it didn't come down evenly across the board. In some places it came down more, in some places it came down differently. And schools have been the last place to go, simply not because of the difficulty of integrating schools alone, but of course of residential segregation, which is a function of lots of different things. No, it was obvious very early on that schools were going to be the most difficult thing to do, and actually integration went up pretty high up to around the mid-80s, and then went into a state of decline.
What are your thoughts on seeing public schools, particularly inner-city schools now? There are so many inner-city schools that are, nearly completely African-American, and so many suburban schools that are very white. You could argue that in a lot of ways, school segregation still exists.
Well, that's right. Oh, it is a terrible, terrible tragedy. What can be done about it? Well, there are some things that can be done about it. For example, in Boston, there's a program called METCO, in which on a voluntary basis, Boston inner city kids go to school in the suburbs, and it's immensely successful. These kids almost all go on to college. They've all ended up being successes in whatever they've tried to accomplish in life. And it is so successful. There's a waiting list of 13,000 to get into that program. And there are a couple of other programs like that around the country. The Leave No Child Behind Act has a provision in it which provides that if you are going to a terrible school, you have a right to transfer to a better school. But it doesn't allow you to transfer to school outside of your district. And if you look at my new edition, I propose that the law be amended to make that possible.
You know, on the 50th anniversary of Brown versus Board of Ed, I'd like you to reflect for a moment about what you now think is the strength of the courts to bring about social change in America, and what are the limitations of the courts' ability to create social change?
Well, the courts can't do everything by themselves. They can set a standard. They can give an impetus. They can prevent some bad things from happening. But all Brown said was, you know, you may not segregate the schools. It didn't say that you had to be virtuous. You had to care. You had to make an effort to make things better. The courts, the Congress, individuals, no single institution or approach to a problem can do it all by itself. What Brown did was, though, the metaphor that I've liked to use, it was like an icebreaker that went through a frozen sea, and it broke up the frozen racial situation that we had in the United States, and it made the Civil Rights Act possible. And it made possible a situation in which, at the time of Brown, there were two black congressmen, and now they're 40. There was no black mayor of a major city. Now every major city in the country at one time or other has had a black mayor. I think, would have been absolutely, completely unthinkable at the time of Brown, or even 10, 15 years ago, that today the CEO of Time Warner, Citibank, Merrill Lynch, American Express are all black. That's quite something. You've got to balance that off against black unemployment being double that of white and black average income being, you know, 60% of white. And the statistic that always blows me away is that black longevity of a black male in Harlem today is that of a person in Bangladesh. So there, one way of putting it is that the glass is half empty or half full, but in 1954 the glass was completely empty.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been my great pleasure.
Jack Greenberg's memoir, Crusaders in the Courts, has just been published in a new edition. He's one of the lawyers who argued the cases that were combined in Brown versus Board of Education. May 17th will mark the 50th anniversary of this Supreme Court decision, which ended state-sanctioned segregation of the schools.